They plan first to prepare the United States for foreign war under the guise of American defense. Second, to involve us in the war step by step without our realization. Third, to create a series of incidents which would force us into the actual conflict. These plans were, of course, to be covered and assisted by the full power of their propaganda. We have become involved in war from practically every standpoint except actual shooting. Only the creation of sufficient incidents yet remains. You will see the first of these already taking place according to their plan, a plan that was never laid before the American people for their approval. Ladies and gentlemen, only one thing holds this country from war today. That is the rising opposition of the American people. Our system of democracy and representative government is on test today, as it has never been before. We are on the verge of war in which the only victor will be chaos and prostration. We are on the verge of a war for which we are still unprepared, and for which no one has offered a feasible plan for victory. A war which cannot be won without sending our soldiers across the ocean to force a landing in a hostile country. We are on the verge of war, but yet it is not too late to stay out. It is not too late to show that no amount of money or propaganda or patronage can force a free and independent people into war against its will. It is not yet too late to retrieve and maintain the independent American destiny that our forefathers established in this new world. The entire future rests upon your shoulders. It depends on our action, our courage, and our intelligence. If you impose our intervention in this war, now is the time to make your voice heard. Word for word, that was said by Charles Lindbergh, September 11th, 1941.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. We continue with War on Iraq, The Big Picture, a panel discussion recorded earlier this week in Auburn.
Now, some of you may remember Charles Lindbergh was the head of the America First Committee. And I see a lot of parallels between the America First group and the peace groups that are here today. Both the America First and the peace groups of today are a peace movement of anticipation. That's very unusual because it's very hard to tell people they're wrong when nothing has happened yet, when the actions have not occurred yet. So it's very hard for any kind of actual meaningful discussion on something that has not happened. Only the threat, only the spin from both sides. Now, I'd like to give you a breakdown of some of the arguments that we're going to hear tonight and things you've heard before, I'm sure. We're not good, they're not evil, everything is relative. Saying we are good is not saying we are perfect. The fact remains this country, for all its faults and blunders, has always been the greatest beacon of freedom, hope, and charity in history. If you need proof, open up all the borders on earth and the U.S. would look like one giant line to see the producers. Violence only leads to more violence. Here is the truth, which you know in your heads and hearts already. Ineffective, unfocused violence leads to more violence. Limp, panicky, half measures lead to more violence. However, complete, fully thought through, professional, well-executed violence leads to peace because one side is defeated. We aren't worrying about the re-education of people. They are defeated. Now, Japan was a tough nut to crack years back. And when people said we're going to war against Japan back then, it was not a war against Shintoism, even though Japan was a Shinto country. But the fascists that ran Japan remind me of the Islamofascists that run many of these countries in the Middle East today. This is a lesson France has yet to learn. It's all about oil, is another argument. That seems to be the key argument. It's all about oil. If this was about oil, why did we liberate Kuwait and hand it back to the owners, whether you agree with the royal family of Kuwait or not? Wouldn't it be much easier just to take Saudi Arabia, why would we go against Iraq if this was all about oil when we have troops right in Saudi Arabia now? And Saudi Arabia is a very small army. We could take them over easy. Besides, there's oil everywhere. Ever since the oil crisis of the 70s, countries have been starting to drill left and right, and they're finding it everywhere. The reason why Saudi Arabia doesn't have the influence it had back in 73 when we had the oil embargo is that in the open free market, we can get oil everywhere now. We don't need them. They don't have us over a barrel like they used to. Now, in one way, this is about oil. But it's not what you think. Because right now, we get a teeny fraction of our oil from Iraq. And that's only because we don't know where it's coming from on the open market. Sometimes a little bit filters through from the black market. But where the oil is very important, it's not for the United States. If you look at the major countries that are buying oil from Iraq, you have to look at France, Russia, and Germany. The FINA oil company in France is up to their neck in Iraqi oil right now. The Luke oil company in Russia is the same way. Now, whether you're looking at the oil for food program or whether you're looking at the black market, those are the three countries that import most of the oil from Iraq right now. Ironically, those are the three countries that oppose our involvement. So I'm asking you here tonight, if you think that this is a war about big business going after the little people, why is only the American big business important? How about the French big business? How about the German big business? How about the Soviet? Well, not Soviet anymore. How about the Russian big business? How come everybody suddenly has lockjaw when we're talking about major corporations that are making a fortune off Iraqi oil right now? So yes, this is about oil, but this is about French, German, and Russian oil right now. Our intelligence agencies let us down. That's another argument that you hear. Well, I want to tell you, for 25 years, we chained our spies like dogs to a stake in the ground. And now that our house has been robbed, we yell at them for not protecting us. Now, a lot of people think now that we've won the Cold War, we should just sit down and let it start all over again. Now, this is the one that you hear the most. These people are poor and helpless. That's why they're against us. Well, terrorists and their backers are extremely rich. It's the people that they're fooling right now that are the poor ones. And I hear tonight that this is maybe too tough of a nut to crack, so maybe we shouldn't do anything. We should stand back because better the devil you know than what might come after. There is no smoking gun in Iraq. That's another thing we hear all the time. Well, the smoking gun in Iraq is Saddam Hussein. And if you want to give inspections more time to work, I think 12 years is long enough. Many people don't know the difference between the weapons inspections program we had before in the 90s and the program that started right now. Now, that comes under Resolution 1441, which does not say that we have to go on a wild goose hunt on a country the size of Texas with less than 200 people and 8 choppers. That's not what 1441 is all about. It's all about, this is your last chance, you lay out what you have. Our 200 people will then verify what you have. Last year, Mr. Ritter was here, and he is probably the most perplexing person in the modern political scene today, because back in 1999, he warned us about tons of VX nerve gas and biological agents. 1441 says, what did you do with it? Well, Saddam says it didn't even exist. Well, this is what they were warning us about years back. What did he do with it? That's all we want to know. What did you do with this? He's saying it never even existed. And now we're having the inspection process seem to be coming to a close, and people say, well, give it more time. Well, you're confusing the weapons inspection program of the 90s with the weapons inspection program of today, which is not a goose hunt to look in every scientist's basement. And speaking of scientist basement, we have heard that a few weeks ago, the scientists that they said we violated his rights, which is kind of strange that you can violate American rights in the middle of Iraq, but we violated his rights by going into his house and taking out all these documents. Now, all you heard in the press was, how dare they? How dare they go to this man's house and force this out of him? Well, how come it's the UK press that's saying what we found were current nuclear documents? Not from back in the 90s, we're talking about today. How come what we knew back in the 90s was that there was over 4,000 scientists working in their nuclear and biological program? We knew it. He admitted it. Now, suddenly, when he came out with the 12,000 pages last September, he says there's less than 500. Where'd the rest of them go? How come they're under death threats to even talk? And suddenly, we're supposed to believe that they independently say we aren't going to talk to the UN anymore? Nothing happens in Iraq without permission, because you will be killed. So here's what I resolve for the new year. I do not want to let the relativists get away with their immoral thinking and try to draw a line on the head of a pin saying that on the one hand, Saddam is really bad, but on the other hand, we can't do anything about it. This didn't start overnight, folks. This has been going on for 12 years. Have you seen that bumper sticker that says no more Hiroshimas? Well, I want one that says no more Pearl Harbors. Thank you.
Our final panelist is Professor Patrick Keen, formerly of Le Moyne. He was the Francis Phelan Professor of English at Le Moyne. Born in the Bronx, more or less, he says. And he went to Fordham and New York University. He is the author of and editor of several and contributor to several books, mostly, as I noticed, on poetry. They include William Butler Yeats' Contemporary Studies in Literature, Coleridge's Submerged Politics, and the myth, Interaction in the Poetry and Thought of Robert Graves and the Myth of the Devouring Female. And I said that last because that sounded the best. So, Professor Keen, welcome to Auburn, and we'll let you go next.
Thank you, Guy. Well, that last book, I was working out my own difficulties in calling it scholarship, I think. When Roger says no more Pearl Harbors, I agree, especially if it means no more Pearl Harbors like the one that was put on the screen a couple of years ago, Roger. You may wonder after, as Guy says, poetry is my main interest, and I've been interested in literature in the 19th and 20th century, but essentially, quite right, as you detected, poetry in the Romantic tradition. So what in the name of God am I doing here? Talking about a possible war with Iraq. Well, the immediate reason is Kim, who called me up and seemed to be over a barrel and needed somebody to come in and make a semi-plausible case for an invasion. And the other thing is, I think that a case can be made, as you can tell from my hemming and hawing. The case you would make for war is a fairly miserable one. That is to say, this will be a choice of lesser evils, it seems to me. I still hope that things can work out. I agree with Roger that extending the inspections indefinitely makes no sense whatsoever. As he said, the onus or the burden is on Saddam Hussein to voluntarily cooperate. We have examples of that kind of cooperation when a state really wants to disarm. I also have not the slightest doubt that he has considerable stores of chemical and biological agents. They were listed. We have no record of their destruction or paperwork on them during the 4.5 years inspectors have been gone, unless we're very idealistic indeed, and we all hope to be in ways, but we would have to be naive, I think, as well as idealistic, to think that he has not been continuing this. This is an appetite with this man. He has sacrificed his own people more than once in order to continue to pile up these playthings. And they do pose a threat. I don't think it's an imminent threat in the sense that we normally use that word. I think much of his nuclear capacity was, in fact, dismantled during the 91 to 98 inspections. He does have the components of a bomb, and he does have the technical experts on the ground to constitute a nuclear weapon. But unless he gets the fissile material from outside the country, it doesn't pose much of a threat. We'll be able to monitor that. I mean, he can move mobily. He can move things around, chemical and biological stuff, bury them under mosques and private houses upstairs in this church, for all we know. But you can't develop a nuclear program without it being monitored by the United States. Nevertheless, he could get fissile material from outside. There are people who'd be willing to sell it. He is a dangerous man. He is a brute. He's a thug. We don't have to demonize this man. He's a genocidal monster. There it is. That doesn't mean that we have to go to war against him. Though when people say there are a lot of bad people around, I don't think there's any one bad person around that brings this particular witch's cauldron together. And that is to say, a country with intelligent people, no matter how brutally he has suppressed them, oil wealth, which is now being to some extent monitored, we can get into the sanctions later, but which, if something even worse than war happens, and I'll mention what that is, that bounty would again flow to him. So he'd have immense wealth. He'd have a technologically intelligent people that he could press into duty. He has a pan-Arab ambition that I don't think anybody should doubt. And he will have an even more ferocious hatred, if that's possible, of the United States after we have goaded and poked him in the eye now for 12 years. Short, I'm saying there's two reasons that you could make a plausible case, I think, for an invasion of Iraq. And one would be a strategic one. That is to say, if we forget, or at least put out of our minds for the moment, and get into it later, how we came to this situation tonight, with time, as the administration keeps telling us, running out, and just ask ourselves, what would be even worse than an invasion of Iraq, with all of the terrible possibilities that that entails, including some of the things that Keith mentioned and that Virginia alluded to in a larger geopolitical sense. I mean, we're getting into something where we are very likely to be over our heads. The possibility that this man will use those chemical and biological weapons that he doesn't have on Israel or on our own troops. One of my own nightmares is, as we gather in these prepositioning points in Kuwait, or if things alter in Turkey, if he knows he's up against the wall, if we have pushed him to the wall, and we just about have, there is nothing to restrain or deter him from unleashing these terrible weapons on our troops or on Tel Aviv, for example. There's nothing that would prevent him, I think, even if he knew that it was, he might want to go down in a Hitlerian Götterdämmerung, he might ignite his own oil fields, causing an even more catastrophic environmental real disaster, such as he did when he left Kuwait, as you remember, some years ago. Now, these are all the arguments against, and there are even more. So what is it that I'm thinking about strategically that would be even worse, it seems to me, than that? And that even worse thing would be if the United Nations come back, as I gather they have today, and said, well, he's not cooperating, but we want more time, etc., and France and Germany continue to adopt the position that they have. France, of course, hectors us endlessly about any kind of intervention. Occasionally one wishes someone would remind them that if it wasn't for our intervention from 1941 to 45, they would be a Nazi or a Soviet satellite at this point. But nevertheless, they are the French. One of the best arguments for going into Iraq is the fact that the French oppose it, it sometimes seems to me. And now they've added to their laurels by managing to goad one of the few spokesmen in this administration who has widespread respect and who speaks in a calm voice, namely Colin Powell. They sandbagged him at the UN recently, and he's been rather more bellicose recently. I think he's running out of patience with other people as well as the French. So on one level, strategically, it seems to me that even worse than going into Iraq, and we'll doubtless get into the ramifications there, would be for us to say, well, yes, there's really no doubt that he has these chemical and biological weapons, but the UN Security Council is going to veto it if we went back for a second resolution, and we have our so-called coalition of the willing, which is not at all what we would like to have. We can win this war, at least strategically. It seems to me the Iraqi army will melt away in a matter of hours, if not days, and then we're left with something terrifying. The Republican Guard surrounding this fine man and the holding up in Baghdad, which has 5,000 innocent civilians in it. What do we do then? You won't hear from this administration much about the ramifications and possibilities of that. Nevertheless, if we were to just pack up, we would be leaving behind an unresolved crisis, a weakened UN, a United States which would be both, as John Kerry said the other day, a blustering unilateralist and a paper tiger. If you can have anything worse than a blustering unilateralist, it's one that's also a paper tiger, it seems to me. And you would leave on the ground a Saddam Hussein whose prestige would be massively enhanced in that region of the world. And shortly thereafter, almost inevitably and logically, there would be a widespread call for the lifting of sanctions, in which case the money pours back into Iraq. And we have the continued suppression, brutally, of his people. One, as I say, you don't have to demonize this man. His hatred of us would be even greater, and you'd be left with a situation like North Korea. We're willing to talk to North Korea. Why? Because they have a couple of nukes. You know, it helps if you're dealing with the American Empire to have a couple of nuclear weapons in your saddlebags, and I'm glad we are talking to North Korea. But it doesn't send around the world exactly the message we'd like about nuclear proliferation. I mean, the message that goes around is, if you're going to deal with these fellows, you should have a nuclear weapon, so let's get one as soon as possible. And I think that's an argument, indeed, to strike preemptively at Iraq before they develop that capacity. They're dangerous enough as it is. And finally, and I haven't paid attention to the time, so forgive me, but the final thing would be the moral argument, which is not an easy one to make in these circumstances. But I would say, picking up on something that Keith said and something that Roger said as well, that the only justification at this point, the only moral justification, for example, for sanctions, would be regime change. It's perfectly obvious at this point that disarmament in Iraq means regime change. This character will never change his spots. He will go down, I'm convinced. You can't seduce him, I think, even into exile, though I'd be delighted to set him up in Switzerland with 150 or so of his cohorts. Maybe that would be a solution. I still hope, and I'm sure the Bush administration does too, there's some bluff poker in this, but the bluff is about to be called, I think, that there would be an internal coup, unlikely, possible, and then who would you leave in power? Still some of that odious party. The moral reason for, there is no moral reason to retain the sanctions, it seems to me, at this point, without regime change. Therefore, there should be regime change. And secondly, there is a possibility. It may not be a great one, but it is a possibility to get on the right side of history here. To stop supporting, without using any of our moral or economic leverage, to stop supporting repressive regimes such as Mubarak's in Egypt and the wonderful Saudi royal family in Arabia, and to use such leverage as we haven't so far, to get them to open up those societies in ways, not in some sort of stupid way, we pay no attention to cultural differences and the rest, but not to be on the side of history which puts us with oppressors, instead of what the United States at its very best, and God knows it's a checkered past we have, but still, liberators. And I think that's where we belong. So if we could win the war in Iraq, I too would start to move it against it, I fear, if there were thousands of civilian casualties. I don't think that's going to happen. I am worried about booby traps and all the rest of it. I am very worried about this talk recently. That Saddam, like Hitler, would press children into service as soldiers. There's a wonderful moral dilemma for an American soldier facing a 10-year-old with a AK-47. But in any case, the bombs are smarter. Most of our munitions now are smart. We can pinpoint things. We could take out almost everything in the first 24 hours, it seems to me. Maybe then there'd be an internal coup. In short, I don't think we can back down, as I said before, not out of any macho, but just because the strategic consequences of such a withdrawal, I think, would be devastating. And second of all, the chance, slim, one-third, one-fifth, whatever, that we could set up a state, Americans, but others, that's why we need a coalition, not to win the war. We don't need anybody to win that. We need people afterwards to get in there and try to transform that state. It will be long. You don't hear that about from the Bush administration either, about the terrible complexity of such a task. But that state, if transformed, could serve as a model in that region of the world, and we could have a genuine transformation. I don't see much happening in that direction if we leave that man indefinitely in power.
The thing that I have a hard time wrapping my head around, and I have since intentions on Iraq were announced, is you've all said now probably going to happen, but I still wonder why. Nobody's made a case to me. why it's going to happen, why people, why the administration wants it to happen. The administration hasn't made a case for the war. And I'm stumped, absolutely stumped, why the administration would want to have it happen, except that I come up with some fairly simple answers. Oil. The French and the Russians are the ones with the drilling rights in Iraq right now, not the United States. Halliburton was dealing there during the 90s. I really can't come up with many good answers. Why?
Can I make one brief response to that, which is I don't think it's the oil explanation, but something almost as cynical. I would like somebody someday to mark down the moment when this administration, with no mirrors and with nothing up their sleeve that I could see, performed the act of leisure domain whereby our entire focus shifted from Afghanistan and the hunt for Osama bin Laden.
It's been since the 1st of July that the president has spoken the name Osama bin Laden in public.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
I think that we do have it. We actually can trace this. I mean, the thing that I think that's
keep
important.
Keep them scared.
Well, no, but that's part of it. But I think that there's an actual much more of a sort of a wonkish backstory to this, which is that a series of Bush 1 refugees, diplomatic refugees,
Wolfowitz,
et cetera,
were
in exile and were working for various sort of quasi sort of Middle East studies programs and these sorts of things, think tanks under Washington, D.C., and in the latter 90s wrote a letter to President Clinton saying, you know, you've got to do something about Iraq. You've got to do something about sort of outlining this whole program. And, you know, that folder was there. And then when Bush 2 became president of the United States, these people were moved from their fake academic positions into the White House. And then September 12th, Paul Wolfowitz said, by the way,
hot diggity,
I've got this folder now that has this plan in it. And frankly, I mean, the sort of deliberate cynicism which with this unfolds strikes me that this has been a plan that's been in the offing for a while. So to answer your question more succinctly, you have to see it as unfinished business from the first Gulf War. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that it's not just about oil, it's about hegemony.
Yes.
In other words, how do you control not just our access to oil, but the world's access to oil? And I think that a subterranean plan within all of this is the United States has come to the conclusion that Saudi Arabia is unstable. Citibank, for example, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, liquidated all their assets in Saudi Arabia. So when Citibank goes, okay, I mean, they can read the writing on the wall, that the United States is intent on moving the bulk of its sort of security over oil forces out of Saudi Arabia into Iraq and Kuwait. And I think this is the broader plan. And I doubt, I mean, the other thing, of course, is, you know, we never found Osama bin Laden. We never found Osama. So, I mean, frankly, you've got to deliver victory. And so there's that. So I will argue, and the poll numbers do support this, Pat, that the president has successfully played to his constituency in this whole issue. And I think has completely abandoned trying to capture the American middle on this issue, because as the elections last, you know, 2 years ago showed, in order to become president, you don't necessarily have to capture the American middle anymore.
Just the Supreme Court.
Right. Well, but beyond that. So, but.
I'm right.
Right. So go ahead.
Okay. Can you tell me why?
First of all, you want to know why we're going to be going into Iraq as part of the larger war on terror?
Well, forget Iraq and terror. I mean, there's no connection.
There's no connection between Iraq and terror.
And no. Okay. The administration has been unsuccessful showing any link. And the administration, for that matter, has been giving us the line, trust us, trust us. Well, you know, the administration is secretive about all things.
You're saying there's no there.
Okay. Well, hold on.
Okay. Why? In a broader war on terror, I'm going to make the analogy to World War II. Just because by the Battle of the Bulge, we hadn't had Hitler yet. Does that mean we were losing the war? The Taliban is in shatters right now. They're a total mess. They're hiding in the hills. And when you look at Afghanistan and say that was a total failure, apparently you didn't see the people dancing in the street shouting pro-American slogans after that. Now, as far as why we should be going into Iraq, It doesn't take a lot of imagination to see that Saddam Hussein has a lot of connections to terrorists. And for us to come out and say, here's the proof. Well, how about if during World War II we said, here's the proof that we know Japan has biological concentration camps. You don't give away your secrets. Because if they give away your secrets, your spies get killed. Now, to draw a story and try to convince people that Saddam is bad, you don't have to do that because everybody agrees that Saddam Hussein is bad. Now, nobody's ever talking about that giant airliner that he has sitting outside of Baghdad that's being used to train terrorists. They have an exact copy of a 767 jet sitting outside of Baghdad, and all of our spies are saying, yes, you know, this is where they help train terrorists. Scott Ritter himself warned us in 99 that he had tons of VX nerve agent, biological agents. His total change of heart doesn't explain what Saddam is doing with this. So what we've got to do is we've got to take care of him now before he comes back and makes things worse. What if we took care of Hitler when the Treaty of Versailles was broken in the 30s? Doesn't take a lot of imagination to see that if we'd taken care of Hitler then, even though that would have hurt the German people, it would have caused, it would have been a big prevention of a future problem.
I'm going to ask you a question that probably is going to, you know, cause a lot of earthquake kind of thoughts in your head, but here's the question anyways. Both of you guys were asked, you two, to speak against intervention. You were asked to speak for intervention. You've done an eloquent job. And I'm going to ask you this. What situation could you imagine that would make you reverse your positions? Okay? In other words, what would make you say, gosh, I was wrong. I think we ought to go to war. What would make you guys say, gosh, I was wrong. We got to stop this right now. It was a terrible idea. Okay? And that's what I'd like to ask you. Okay? That's right. Yeah.
Well, I think the question is really great, and not least because it challenges some of the left to think more a little bit more carefully about any kind of knee-jerk, utter rejection of violence. I think there's been kind of a simplistic, you know, I'm all, you know, great pacifism, but you know, there's a it's a tough world out there, and there have been times as you know, my panel colleague has pointed out that you know we look back on intervention with relief, right, historically. But this, in that spirit, there are two things that might change my mind. One would be if Saddam attacked anybody outside of its borders, right, which would automatically change his position internationally and bring the just action of the international community on him to keep him from doing that. The other is something I wish had happened in the 1980s. And that is if Saddam Hussein chose to spray his Kurdish population or his Shia population with chemical weapons again. Right. When he did that in the 1980s, the United States ignored him, ignored it entirely, supported it, provided him with the means to do it. Right. And we didn't hear a word about it. Right. Now, I wish we were invading Iraq or threatening to invade Iraq because of his wretched human rights record. I wish we did that kind of thing around the world. It's been very miserable watching the world turn away from those kinds of events. On the other hand, again, I fear for the international system because it's a bad thing to attack a country that's inflicting genocide on its own population. I actually support that. But every time we do it, I'm terrified. Because of the complexities that our leadership always sadly seems unprepared to grapple with. I just had a vignette from my colleague Kevin Dunn, who was here some months ago, I believe, to address this group. Wonderful man in my department. He was telling me that he'd been talking to the State Department people, and the State Department were all very frustrated because they had been unable to put an Iraq-Iran expert in the National Security Council all last year. For longer than 6 weeks, because no one could stand to be there for longer than 6 weeks, because no one was listening to them. They couldn't get their words heard. They couldn't be heard. And, of course, what they were offering was in-depth knowledge of the region and the complexities involved, and the National Security Council leadership didn't want to hear that.
One of the things we're trying to do at the Lemoyne College Center for Peace and Global Studies is articulate a vision of peace that is not merely pacifism, because I think that we recognize that pacifism is a can often be, those who practice it vigorously, for them, I think it works, but we just can't understand how it can work in a modern society. That said, I would have to echo Virginia and say that the only basis for intervention in Iraq, and this would be completely legal under the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide, I have one of my former genocide students in the room here who can quote that verbatim, that is the only basis on which I would change my opinion. Were Iraq to be certified by the international community of being in violation of the Genocide Convention, to which it is a signatory, I would support intervention, just as I supported the humanitarian intervention on Kosovo.
Mr. Chair, I would oppose intervention if, like the Ukraine and South Africa, Saddam said, here's what I have. No more bluster. No more jerking us around. This is what I have. The weapons program worked in the Ukraine. It worked in South Africa, and it worked in a few other places because the UN came forward and says, here's your chance. We aren't here to moralize whether you've been good or bad. We just want to know what you have, and then our inspectors can verify that you've brought it all out. But after 12 years and obfuscation after obfuscation, I don't see that anymore. And the logic that I hear from so many people is to want to go back and fight the political arguments of 20 years ago. Well, people forget that back then we really didn't like Iran because we had a nasty little problem with them down near the end of the Jimmy Carter term. So the logic that I hear now is that since we're partly responsible for creating Frankenstein, we're doomed to suffer as rampages.
Yeah, good point. Well, I agree. If he came clean according to the both the spirit and the letter of 1441, I would not only be opposing the war, but actively opposing the war. I think it would still leave a terrible situation in Iraq, but we would have achieved the immediate goal. And you can't transform the world into something that's perfect. The second reason I would oppose the war would be, I believe even after it started, would be if there were in fact serious, and it's stupid to say, put any adjective in front of it, if there were serious to massive civilian casualties, I believe that we should pull out no matter how, no matter what it looked like for American quote-unquote prestige.
Do you think, first of all, do you think that an action like this leads to an inevitable second terrorist attack? And if you do, do you think that this accelerates that plan or exacerbates the intensity of the attack?
I can go. I think your whole premise is don't make the bad guy angry because you come back at us. I think you have a lot of these people are very angry at us now.
One of the problems, and one of the reasons I put that map up of the Muslim world, is to show about its geographic spread. This is I'm just going to talk about the Middle East for a second. This is a part of the world in which people are enormously frustrated. They've been living under rotten governments for a long time, and they have been, they're frustrated at every level. There have been democratization efforts that have been stifled, unionization movements that have been ruined. Parliaments that have been destroyed, and also the Palestinian-Israel situation is just on their news every night the way we don't get it, right? People, soldiers beating women in the face and these kinds of scenes that we just don't see, and they see every night and are enraged by and infuriated by and frustrated by because there doesn't seem to be any way out. When you have such a situation, you end up with a population of people, a certain number of whom, a certain percentage or portion or sector of whom, will decide that religion is their banner, righteous emblem, right? Christians do it too, okay? It's not exclusive to Muslims, right? That God is on our side and God is righteous and these are evil people and our governments are failing to oppose them and we are going to give our lives in the name of righteousness. Now, we've seen the immediate impact of that on our country. One of the great fears of people who are watching this invasion loom is that that by violating the international consensus, by going against the United Nations, by acting unilaterally like the old-fashioned imperialists of yore, those people will multiply, will triple, quadruple in number, will link into new and greater networks than they already have, will obtain more dangerous substances with which to act, and will give their lives to oppose the criminal United States. I mean, this is their view, right? I actually, if we go against international law, we are violating international law. So, you know, I mean, we just say it doesn't matter to us. We're above it. We don't have to pay attention to it. That can look like criminality to people who then turn against us. Where are we going to be able to fly after this? Where are we going to be able to send our students on programs abroad and feel like they're safe? These are the kinds of, you know, dangers unleashed that are frightening. I just add one little horrible story. In the Cold War, when Afghanistan was being fought over by the Soviets were trying to crush the Islamic resistance to forced collectivization and all those nasty policies that had been rammed down their throats by an extremist party. The United States spent $1.2 billion pumping up Muslim schools and Muslim Mujahideen resistance networks. $1.2 billion. The Saudis cooperated with this by spending another $1.2 billion. $2.4 billion worth of little schools teaching, you know, ignorant young kids only one thing, which is the Quran, and instilling in them a militant ideology has created a Middle East now that's really quite different from what it was 20 years ago. One of the architects of that, Brzezinski, said at the time, what's a few stirred up Muslims when you're talking about the fall of the Soviet Union? What a small price to pay. This man is so abashed now. He's like a tragic figure. You see him on television and his face is just, he's aged 10 years, right? Because now he knows what a few stirred up Muslims can mean and what a short-sighted policy that was. And that's how I see this. That this is a nothing is inevitable. But I think it's a very great danger, and it's one of the things that people are very much afraid of with this invasion. It's a short-sighted policy with an insufficient appreciation of how the region is working.
Thanks. You know, as I'm listening to the four of you and as I'm hearing all the radio shows and reading the newspaper articles about this over the last 9 months, I'm trying to put it into perspective, you know, which is hard to do because we have a global community now in a way that we haven't before. But I look around me and I think, how is this going to change here? How is this going to benefit us here? You know, and having been to Manhattan, I've seen where the World Trade Center used to be. It's awful. No one can ever argue against that. But then I think about our nation as something like a household, which can be pretty hard to run. And in a household, you never just make a decision. For example, if I were to say to my wife, hey, you want to go to the movies? She would quickly remind me that it's not just a decision of, do you want to go to the movies? Because the money that we would spend on the movies and the babysitter, probably some of the popcorn, could be used to pay down our debt or to have a better meal on Friday, you know, save up for our son's college. So I'm thinking about the decision to go to war in terms of that kind of perspective. You know, I think if you look around the towns here, it's pretty easy to see we're going through a hard time. You know, storefront after storefront's closed down. Just up the road from me, there's a gas station that's been there forever, and the Sunoco sign is down. I went in, you know, take my car for inspection. He said, we just don't have the money. People are moving away because they can't find the jobs. We see that, you know, in our state, they're talking about cutting Medicare. They're talking about cutting the spending on education. When my son goes to kindergarten soon, the schools won't have the funding because the funding isn't there at the state level, not there at the federal level. Things are crashing down all around us. And so I guess I kind of want to ask the question in the sense of the household economy. There's a lot of stuff that we can spend money on. Hundreds of billions of dollars right now are going to pump up our defense budget, are going to be spent directly in war over there. We know that in the next few years, because of the budget decisions that have been made by this administration, that Medicare is going to be cut. Social Security benefits are being cut for old people. There are people who die every day in the United States because they don't have the access to the health care that they could have if the government put the money there. So my question to the four of you is, what makes a war against Iraq right now so important that we can't spend the money on the people here at home?
You brought up a major point here, and that's that besides the fact that safety and the economy are linked, you go under the assumption that Social Security is being cut. It is not. Absolutely not. And this is one of the leftist myths that's been perpetuated for many years. It's just that it was scheduled for a 15% cut, an increase, and now it's only going to get an 8%.
I'm sorry, sir, but the Bush plan for Social Security does cut the
benefits. No, it does not. It does not. It absolutely does not.
If we could just stay on Iraq and
I think one of the issues is expense and cost. The estimate is it's costing us right now about $1 billion a month to sort of police Afghanistan, and this seems to be indefinite. So that's $12 billion a year, which is not that much in terms of sort of the gross domestic product of the United States, but that's $12 billion a year that's not going somewhere else. I think that in terms of costing, which I guess is some sort of bureaucratic word, costing the war in Iraq, it will probably be 4 or 5 times more expensive per month. Iraq is a much larger country, a much more populous country. The only difference between Iraq and one of the major differences between Iraq and Afghanistan is, whereas in Afghanistan, the major source of revenue is heroin, which unfortunately the United States is now allowed to be replanted, opium poppies. In Iraq, it's oil. And the United States has a plan to use Iraqi oil to pay for the American occupation of Iraq under the rubric of the redevelopment of Iraq. And this is a very old scheme. It was used by the British when they first occupied Iraq at the end of this First World War. So the issue, I think, kind of an issue that we have to think about is that we're going to use the wealth of Iraq to pay for our attack on Iraq and occupation of Iraq, and in many ways take money away from Iraqis. Conceivably, they won't be spending it on weapons or weapons of mass destruction, so perhaps Iraqis will do better. But there are deep social costs. And ultimately, there's also human costs. And it's hard to put a number on that. I was just one of my students came and just told me that one of the students that I'm very fond of has just been called up. And I don't know where she's going to be sent. So we need to, in addition to sort of the broader social costs and monetary costs, think about the human costs. Which is very, very real.
I accept a large part of what you say and reject a large part of what Keith just said. First of all, to say what Virginia said too, in spite of the fact that we did have a policy which came back and bit us in the behind, but people on the left always seem to be amazed somehow that the old doctrine of the enemy of my enemy is my friend is sometimes necessary. The Soviet Union did present a somewhat more formidable threat than the Afghanistan Mujahideen. So these things happen, realpolitik and the rest of it. The rest is with Iraq and the oil and the redevelopment of Iraq. If somehow the war, a war could be successfully prosecuted and people could be put in there to make an attempt, and I agree with Virginia and Keith, it'll be one hell of a task, and I don't think the American public is ready for it because this administration has made not the slightest effort. We can't even cut back on SUVs, you know, in this country, let alone start paying. In any case, if that could happen, I don't have the slightest problem with some Iraqi oil being used to pay for the transformation of that society. Where's the problem? The Iraqi people are not realizing a lot of the wealth of Iraqi oil to begin with. Saddam Hussein complain about sanctions all he wants, but he still has enough pennies in his piggy bank to build 50 opulent palaces in the last 10 years and continue to put poison in pails. So I don't have a problem with that whatsoever. That would seem to me to be good economical sense. What do you think, Roger?
I definitely agree, and I think it'll be even more expensive if we wait for him to come and drop some anthrax or BX nerve agent somewhere. It'll cost us trillions going down the drain if something like that happens. So this is a war to prevent something happening in the future. It's hard to quantify because we're talking, again, with something that has not even happened. But this man has a 100% success rate of messing us up and lying and spending for weapons instead of feeding his own people.
In the movie, I think it was Crimson Tide, there was a statement that said, in a nuclear age, the real enemy is war itself. I like to consider myself a true American because I believe true Americans want to get to the truth. Now, Noam Chomsky says, in a dictatorship, you rule by force. In a democracy, you rule by propaganda. I don't see the peace groups being aired. All these huge peace groups going on globally, I do not see them being aired by Dan Rather and all those guys. You can find this information on the internet with the London Times and the Tehran Times. You can get a totally different view of what's going on. There's propaganda being hoisted on us, the American people, so we cannot make a truly democratic decision based on truth, because the truth is being twisted by other forces. Now, I find that follow the money, you tend to find the truth pretty quick, and that a lot of basic politics is just basic money and power. Wall Street Journal, my friend said, last Monday, they said it was in there. Halliburton already had contracts for the oil that's going to be coming out of Iraq.
My sense, and what I've been telling people, and you'll get to the sanctions have done more to help Saddam Hussein than just about anyone else, as far as I can tell. In Iraq, they've turned into a tool of social control, and they really have hurt the wrong people. An Iraqi colleague of mine said it's made the wrong people rich and the right people poor, primarily the Iraqi middle class who could have eventually opposed Saddam. What I've been trying to tell people, and this has sort of become a slogan of mine, is that the Iraqis cannot fight Saddam, the sanctions, and the United States all at the same time. And I believe that firmly. But if I could, I mean, I'm not a politician. I'm an academic. I sort of live in this weird academic world where we write papers, we have students, we give lectures. And so it's been a very brutal awakening for me as I've come back, had to face journalists and so on, and just how nothing that I say ever comes out in the newspapers the way I thought I said it. But my sense of coming back, and this is something I think that's been very sort of an interesting awakening for me, is that, for example, I was brutally misquoted by the Weekly Standard or the Daily Standard, which is the Weekly Standard's online edition. This is not like the Syracuse Post Standard. This is the far right wing journal that Bill Kristol, who you see on television a lot, edits, where I was just sort of belittled as some sort of wacky peacenik. This wacky peacenik who went to Iraq and really hates the Iraqi people so much that I don't want them to be attacked. I mean, so, and the most ironic thing about it is that he accused me of supporting the regime, whereas if he had just quoted correctly the Washington Post article where I appeared in, I said, we're here out of no love for the regime. Had he bothered to call me up and ask me, I would have told him I delivered two interviews in Arabic to two Arab language newspapers in which I strongly denounced the regime, addressing the human rights concerns that we all have. But what this points to is that the argument in favor of war against Iraq right now is so weak that the only possible alternative that those opposed to war can use is to ridicule those opposed to war. The only tool that those in favor of war can use now is ridiculing those of us opposed to the war. So they can no longer attack the message. They have to attack the messenger. And except for people here who have been very, very erudite in their criticism. However, I see that as a position of strength, because when people have to just attack that homonym way, they've essentially lost the argument. The American public is smart enough to see through that.
That was War on Iraq, The Big Picture, a panel discussion recorded earlier this week in Auburn, sponsored by the Cayuga Coalition for Peace. The coalition will be holding another event on February 21st, Hearts of Peace, a fundraiser for humanitarian aid at home and abroad. The venue will be the First United Methodist Church at 99 South Street, Auburn, Friday, February 21st. Soups will be served at 6 p.m., followed by performances of music, poetry, and dance at 7. For updates or questions, call the Hearts of Peace message line at area code 315-689-6815. That's 689-6815. There is a suggested donation of from $3 to $5, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds. Attendees are also asked to bring a non-perishable food item. Donations from this fundraiser will be split between Voices in the Wilderness, an international organization dedicated to providing medical supplies to victims of war and injustice around the world, and a local food pantry. We'll also post this information about the Hearts of Peace event on the Unwelcome Guests website.
We're going to talk to people all night. We're going to talk to people about homelessness. We're going to talk to experts about various aspects of homelessness. We're going to talk to homeless people.
Coming live from the streets of Portland, Maine.
Everybody needs to work together because this earth of ours is all one home.
I learn a lot. Homeless people, they stick together. They look out for each other. I learn a lot about people.
The 6th Annual Homelessness Marathon. A 14-hour national town hall on homelessness and poverty in America.
When you become homeless, they actually put you in a mental, like you're mentally disabled. And I'm not mentally disabled.
The Homelessness Marathon on this radio station.
So you make a little money for somebody else's sweat.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
One day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.